The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Time Magazine. Today's program is supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com, that is gsuggsinsurance.com. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine, the March 23, 2026 edition. Time Magazine, as usual, features a red border on the cover with a narrow white inner border. Time is in white, large block capital lettering, superimposed upon a pale gray, even off-white background. Centered in the front of the cover is a photograph of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 red baseball caps. Each of them has a different slogan stitched across the front. Make Iraq great again. Make Somalia great again. Make Syria great again. Make Yemen great again. Make Venezuela great again. Make Iran great again. Make Nigeria great again. Make Ecuador great again. The first article is from the bulletin, Pakistan and Afghanistan Fight Over Insurgency, by Miranda Jayaratnam. Pakistan declared open war with Taliban-led Afghanistan after the two governments escalated attacks on each other in late February. Our cup of patience has overflowed. Now it is open war between us and you, Pakistan's Defense Minister Khawaja Asif wrote in a social media post February 27. The declaration followed attacks between the countries that shattered a fragile ceasefire in place since October, when the two neighbors, which share a 1,600-mile mountainous border, traded airstrikes and were locked into intense border clashes and deadly ground fighting. Taliban forces are equipped with arms left behind by the U.S. when it withdrew in 2021. The two South Asian nations have a complex history. During the 20 years the U.S. was fighting the Taliban, Pakistan was obliged to become a base against an Islamist movement it had helped foster and was frequently accused of allowing Taliban fighters to shelter just inside its border. After the Taliban returned to power as the U.S. withdrew, Pakistan made the same complaint that the new government was hosting militants dubbed the Pakistan Taliban, blamed for a spate of recent suicide bombings. Between militant attacks and combat-related deaths, including several days of battles with India, Pakistan's neighbor on the other side, 2025 was Pakistan's deadliest year in more than a decade. Pakistan bombed Afghanistan's two biggest cities, Kabul and Kandahar, as well as the border province of Paktia, after days of clashes. Islamabad says it targeted camps allegedly belonging to the militant groups accused of carrying out terrorist attacks in Pakistan. Afghanistan responded with attacks on Pakistani border troops. Casualty claims have greatly varied. Pakistan claimed more than 130 Taliban were killed and 200 wounded. Afghanistan reported no casualties at all. Kabul said earlier Pakistani attacks hit civilian homes and a religious school and killed at least 18 people. Afghanistan's former president, Hamid Karzai, said the country would respond to aggression with courage. The top half of this page features a photograph. The caption reads, "Punch Drunk Love." There are two characters, one animate and one inanimate, that populate this photograph, the back of which looks to me like a gray concrete wall. The foreground looks like a dirt floor. There's a monkey, a primate of some kind, seated on the dirt floor. It's a pretty gray, brown, silver, white mix, and it has big brown eyes that are focused very specifically on a big, brown, plush, monkey-looking toy. Here's the caption. Punch. A 7-month-old Japanese macaque reaches out to his stuffed orangutan at Ichikawa City Zoo in Japan, February 19. Punch won hearts around the world with his love for the toy, a gift from zookeepers that he seemed to find comfort in after being rejected by his mother and his peers. And since going viral, he's even been seen playing with the other monkeys. Turning the page to the brief news, good question. What does the Supreme Court ruling on tariffs mean for me? By Miranda Jayaratnam. There's a photo here of a big ship next to a dock. The dock has rows and lines of cars on it. The caption, it's not a very big photo. It's blue sky in the background, blue water on the side foreground, and the several big slabs of dock cement in the foreground. There's a skyline of skyscrapers in the far background. Preparing to unload vehicles at a Chinese port in February, reads the caption. Since the Supreme Court struck down Donald Trump's emergency tariffs, questions have mounted around what the ruling means for consumers and businesses that already paid the price of the trade policy. February 20, the court ruled 6-3 that Trump could not use the 1977 International Emergency Economic Powers Act, IEEPA, to impose import duties by declaring a national emergency. That effectively rolled back the sweeping Liberation Day tariffs Trump imposed last April, as well as levies on China, Mexico, and Canada that he tied to the flow of fentanyl into the U.S. The ruling does not reverse all tariffs. Any tariffs imposed under Section 232 of the 1962 Trade Expansion Act, including on steel and aluminum, remain in place. Those are based on Commerce Department investigations into whether certain imports threaten U.S. national security. Meanwhile, Trump, whose administration has argued tariffs have generated important revenue for the U.S. government and given it leverage to secure more favorable trade terms and investment pledges from other countries, invoked Section 122 of the 1974 Trade Act to impose a 10% tariff on all countries, over and above our normal tariffs already being charged, which he later raised to the maximum 15%, valid only up to 150 days. These tariffs could still face legal challenges. The administration's also planning to launch accelerated investigations under Section 232 and Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974, U.S. Trade Representative Jameson Greer said. The ruling has also threatened to upend trade agreements that the U.S. struck with countries seeking to lower Trump's emergency tariff rates, resulting in potentially more price fluctuations for American consumers. The EU paused ratifying its trade deal with the U.S. as the European Commission seeks clarification about whether the bilateral agreement will be honored. A slew of countries that were either subject to a baseline 10% tariff or who had negotiated their tariff rates down could end up with higher tariffs. Some countries, like Japan and South Korea, also pledged massive investments to the U.S. in order to secure trade deals, which now appear less favorable. Global Trade Alert suggests the U.K., Japan, South Korea, and some EU countries that struck deals with the U.S. will now pay more than they did before the ruling and new tariffs. Countries like Singapore and Australia that were paying the 10% baseline tariff before will also be subject to higher 15% tariffs. By contrast, China, Brazil, and India benefit most, as the 15% tariff replaces much higher IEEPA tariffs. Democrats began calling for the federal government to issue refunds for the roughly $130 billion in import duties that the Trump administration collected. Senate Democrats announced legislation that would require full refunds with interest of the money collected from the emergency tariffs, amounting to around $175 billion. If enacted into law, those refunds would be issued to businesses that paid import duties, though some companies passed on all or part of the cost to consumers by hiking prices. Some Democrats have called for direct refunds to consumers. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, a potential Democratic presidential primary candidate in 2028, shared on social media a letter he sent Trump, invoicing him for $8.7 billion, or $1,700 for every family in Illinois. California Governor Gavin Newsom, who has also teed up a potential presidential run in 2028, said Donald Trump has been illegally taxing your groceries, furniture, and cars for over a year. Time for a refund. But the president signaled that his administration has no intention of issuing refunds anytime soon, telling reporters the issue could be in court for up to 5 years. When he was asked about refunds, Justice Brett Kavanaugh, one of the three Supreme Court justices to side with Trump, who nominated him to the court in 2018, noted in his dissent that refunding tariffs would create a mess. The president has not given up on his signature policy, with the impact on consumers remaining to be seen. From the milestones page, there are two primary articles that I will read first, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 thumbnail sketches in the column on the left. Switched BC to DST, a constant clock. Things will be sunnier in British Columbia going forward. That is because the Canadian province decided, after it sets its clocks ahead for daylight saving time, March 8, well, let's hope they already did that, it is not going back to standard time in the fall. Polling shows the move is popular, but it comes with risks. On daylight time, clock time is less aligned with the sun than it is on standard time, and that can mess with our body's circadian rhythms, which in turn can lead to all manner of health woes. One 2025 paper estimated eliminating DST would lower the U.S. prevalence of stroke by 300,000 cases. A Spanish study found a 30% increase in fatal car accidents from 1990 to 2014 on the day clocks spring forward. A 2020 study found medical errors, like giving the wrong medicine to a patient, rise by as much as 8.8% in the week following the switch. But even as the perils of DST become more evident, the U.S. is, if anything, moving in the wrong direction, with Congress annually considering a so-called Sunshine Protection Act, that would follow BC in making DST permanent. But at least North America remains an outlier. Only about a third of countries around the world observe DST at all. That column was by Jeffrey Kluger. The next column, also on the milestones page, is by Chad de Guzman. It is titled Died, Eric, E-R-I-C, Dane, D-A-N-E, Actor, and ALS Advocate. Actor Eric Dane, known for his many roles, including on TV shows Grey's Anatomy and Euphoria, died February 19 at age 53, following a courageous battle with ALS, a statement from his representatives said. He spent his final days surrounded by dear friends, his devoted wife, and his two beautiful daughters, Billy and Georgia, who were the center of his world, it added. Dane announced last year he had been diagnosed with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS, a rare and swiftly progressing neurodegenerative disease, that erodes a person's motor neurons till they eventually lose control of their muscles, ending their ability to walk, talk, eat, and eventually breathe, according to the ALS Association. There's no cure, and people on average live only 2 to 5 years after diagnosis. It affects about 350,000 people globally. After being diagnosed, the actor threw himself into ALS advocacy, partnering with organizations to secure funding for research into a cure for the disease. Dane was included in the 2026 Time 100 Health List in recognition of his work. Dane started his career with guest roles on TV shows, including The Wonder Years, Roseanne, and Married with Children. But it was Shonda Rhimes' long-running medical drama, Grey's Anatomy, that made him a star. He portrayed the dashing plastic surgeon, Dr. Mark Sloan, popularly nicknamed McSteamy. He entered the show's second season in 2006 as a guest star, but became a series regular for 6 seasons. Dane said he felt fortunate to continue working after his diagnosis, including reprising his role in HBO's Euphoria, the third and likely last season, of which is scheduled to premiere in April. Speaking to Time earlier this year about his advocacy and acting, Dane said, "If my actions can move the needle forward for myself and countless others, I am satisfied." All right, from the small items on the left-hand column, the first one is accompanied by a photograph of a dashing young man. My goodness, I bet it's from the 70s because he's got longish hair, long sideburns, a black coat. We don't see anything below the edge of the bottom of the coat. A black coat with wide lapels. I can't tell if it's double-breasted or not. And peering out from the top of the jacket, a ruffly peach-colored shirt. Died Neil Sedaka, who co-wrote and sang pop hits of the 50s and 60s, including Breaking Up Is Hard to Do. He died February 27. He was 86. Testified Hillary and Bill Clinton in the House Oversight Committee's investigation into the late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, February 26 and 27. The couple said they had no knowledge of Epstein's crimes. Fired Kristi Noem as Homeland Security Secretary, President Donald Trump announced March 5, saying she would be made a special envoy for the Shield of the Americas. Noam has faced criticism for her oversight of Trump's immigration crackdown. Convicted, Colin Gray, the father of the teenage suspect in a 2024 shooting at Georgia's Appalachee High School of second-degree murder in connection with the shooting, March 3. Resigned, Laurence Dakar, as president of the Louvre Museum in Paris, February 24. In October, a theft at the museum sparked concerns about its security measures. Turning the page to the brief, health. Five phrases that will instantly get your doctor's attention, by Angela Haupt. Doctors do not just examine bodies, they also decode language. Some words and phrases make them lean in, ask more questions, rethink what might be going on. A clear, detailed conversation with a patient gets you 80% there on a diagnosis, says Dr. Robert Birnbaum, chief medical officer at WellNow Urgent Care, which has locations in five states. That's how important words are. They are the most important thing we do in adult medicine. There's no need to use medical jargon you picked up while Googling your symptoms, he adds. If a patient informs him they think they have pneumococcal pneumonia, for instance, that could set the diagnostic process back. He has to start over and ask them why they think that. The most helpful language is honest and specific and focuses on changes over time and day-to-day impact, Birnbaum adds. It is most important to opt for words that signal heightened risk, capture trajectory, or shine light on functional impact rather than just discomfort. The goal is not to say the right word, he says. It is to clearly communicate what is different, how long it's been happening, why it concerns you. That is what helps clinicians take the right next step. The importance of language speaks to why everyone should have a primary care doctor, says Dr. Adam Strocker, chief medical officer and director of primary care at Weill Cornell Medicine. When you know a patient and their personality, their fears, their anxieties, it is easier to know when something's really wrong, he says. There are some patients who are a little more anxious and others who are more stoic, and that helps you parse how seriously to take something. We asked doctors which phrases always catch their attention and why. Five here, five phrases with explanations. This has been going on for months. When you are describing symptoms to your doctor, it is key to include how long you've had them. You might use a word like persistent, says Dr. James Tachi, president-elect of the American College of Preventive Medicine. The fact that any abnormality is persistent makes it more than trivial, he says. It does not necessarily mean it is bad, but it means it is something that needs to be addressed. I had to stop going to the gym. One of the most important things doctors want to know is how much symptoms are changing your daily life. Birnbaum is especially alert to phrases like interfering with sleep, can't work, can't eat, can't walk, and I had to stop doing X. When people start saying things like, I haven't missed a day of work in 5 years, and I had to call in because I cannot work because the pain is too bad, you listen, he says. I had a sudden change in strength. The word sudden signals the timeline has shifted in an important way. Strocker pays particular attention to phrases like these: sudden loss of vision, sudden shortness of breath, sudden change in strength. The sudden, acute onset of anything gives us a higher level of suspicion that something urgent is wrong, he says. I have a family history of skin cancer. Your family medical history might be recorded in your patient portal, but that does not necessarily mean your doctor remembers your dad had a heart attack at 52. It makes so much difference if you have a family history of whatever it is that you are being tested for, because it puts you in a whole new category, Tachi says. That makes every physician appropriately stop, take pause, and say, okay, let's make sure we are on the right page for you based on your genetics. I have a sharp chest pain that worsens with exertion and improves with rest. A helpful rule of thumb, precision beats vagueness. Providers respond most strongly to clear, concrete descriptions, Birnbaum says, rather than broad statements like, I've never felt worse in my life. They need specifics about timing, triggers, and symptoms to make the best decisions. Very precise descriptions are so important for us to get to the bottom of something. From The View, with its large headlines, The World Freezing But Free, by Daria Kolemich. Kolemich is a Ukrainian activist and DJ. I am writing from Kiev, where the temperature in my apartment barely reaches 40 degrees Fahrenheit. I sleep in thermal underwear, an insulated tracksuit, and a winter hat. Recently, I added gloves. Russian attacks have destroyed 80% of our energy and heat infrastructure. Working to keep Ukraine cold in what is apparently an attempt to turn us against one another. Instead, neighbors cook borscht for the entire building. Electricity can disappear for 3 days or more, heat and water too. Compared with many, I'm lucky I have a gas stove. I'm also 37 years old and have all my limbs. I can walk up the stairs to my home without an elevator and carry heavy bottles of water. I can even find a yoga studio where I shower and wash my hair. Unfortunately, I cannot say the same for the elderly, for people with disabilities, for veterans without limbs who need electricity to charge their prosthetics, or for those who have lost their homes and simply have nowhere to go. Freezing but free, that's how I would describe the mood in Kiev. We are tired, but we are not broken, and our perseverance can be measured in days. It's been almost 1,500 of them, 4 years and counting, since Russia invaded. I marked one, January 13, 2026, on my calendar, the day Ukraine had officially been resisting longer than the Soviet Union fought Nazi Germany during World War II, the largest and bloodiest conflict of the 20th century. A common meme shared among soldiers, I've been fighting longer than my grandfather did. My foreign friends often tell me Ukrainians have a particular sense of humor. In Kiev, the new joke goes, if the Russian missiles and drones didn't kill you today, watch out for dangling icicles. When the war had gone on for 2 years, I wrote an essay marking the anniversary. A lot has changed in the 2 years since. Irina Shibuk, a public activist, a combat medic, and my friend, was killed May 24, 2024, on the front line near Kharkiv, just days before her 26th birthday. Around then, I was in New York preparing a benefit reading of the documentary theater piece I created, Diary of War, which Irina contributed to. American veterans were performing diary of war to raise funds for Irina's medical battalion, Hospitallers. It was unbearable. Organizing an event in honor of my friend in New York while our friends were burying her in Kiev. Irina changed how we say goodbye to those killed in action. In her will, she asked that mourners at her funeral sing Ukrainian songs, that we not bring flowers but donate to Hospitallers. Instead of Soviet-style monuments, Irina asked for living remembrance. Every day at 9 a.m., people in Kiev and other Ukrainian cities stop to honor those killed by Russia. Yuri Shibuk, Irina's younger brother, recently raised and donated more than $3,000 to continue a university scholarship in her name. And I created the playlist for Irina's funeral, a collection of Ukrainian songs that were a soundtrack to her young life. A funeral playlist for my friend. Every person in Ukraine has their own diary of war, and every object does too, from my playlist to the box of Russian chocolates I bought for a friend. After I purchased them from a store in Kiev, the chocolates gained a new meaning and value when Russia destroyed the factory. It can feel impossible to feel, to measure it all. Remembrance, grief, survival, the fight for identity, burying friends, searching for love, living in complete uncertainty with a very short planning horizon. Over the past 4 years, Ukrainians have learned not just to endure shocks, but to grow from them. We've all had to become masters of kintsugi, the Japanese art of repairing broken pottery in our own lives. We've learned how to glue everything back together by mourning, to replace windows blown up by drones, to find alternative ways to heat our homes, to invent new ways to keep fighting. War is a total loss of control over your own life, so I hold on to what I can still influence, telling the truth. Faced with propaganda and indifference, I try to share with the world what cannot be understood without living through it. I hope that someone is listening. The full-scale war has required all Ukrainians to make sacrifices we had not imagined, but the Russians were wrong. The cold cannot break us. We turn to each other for warmth. We look to each other for light in the dark. We are still here, even if you no longer see us on the front pages of newspapers. But what we cannot endure is isolation. When the world forgets us, we feel profoundly alone. In the vastness of primal cold and endless darkness, no winter can compare to that. The Risk Report by Ion Bremmer, contributing editor. President Claudia Sheinbaum scored a major win last month when Mexican Special Forces killed Ruben Nemesio El Mencho Oseguera, leader of the country's most powerful criminal organization. This is no ordinary drug gang. Its network involves not just fentanyl trafficking to the U.S., but also illegal mining, extortion, and human trafficking. And unlike most cartels, which have a hierarchical command structure, this organization operated through alliances with local gangs and smaller criminal groups, allowing it to expand operations across much of Mexico. But Oseguera's death has also raised the stakes in Sheinbaum's battle to both contain her country's drug violence and ease pressure for action against the cartels from the Trump administration. The capture or killing of cartel leaders often triggers a surge in deadly violence as factions struggle over control of the organizations and retaliate against authorities. The 2024 capture of Ismael El Mayo Zambada, provoked a major and sustained escalation of violence several weeks after the arrest. Since Osaguera's killing, deadly attacks have spread across cartel strongholds in a half dozen states. Sheinbaum's first priority is to prevent localized violence from spreading to places like Guadalajara, an industrial and investment hub that will host World Cup matches later this year, and to protect businesses, highways, and other key infrastructure. It's worth noting Sheinbaum has adopted a much more systematic security strategy than that of her predecessor and political ally, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. The result of both her security-focused mindset and her recognition that violent crime remains the top concern of voters. But it's also a product of pressure from Washington for more direct coordination between security forces on both sides of the border, as the U.S. has provided critical intelligence and help containing the flow of guns into Mexico. Sheinbaum's worked hard to persuade Trump she shares his concerns about border security, partly in hopes of avoiding further U.S. action on trade or any risk that U.S. security forces might move against the cartels within Mexico, compromising its sovereignty. Sheinbaum sent a number of captured cartel members to the U.S., and Trump has publicly celebrated a major drop in fentanyl seizures since he became president, a success each can credit to tighter cooperation between the two governments. But the killing of El Mencho confirmed for U.S. officials that the Mexican government would take direct forceful action against the cartels, raising expectation in Washington that more strikes might follow. Trump's aggressive and unilateral moves against Venezuela and Cuba have heightened concerns in Mexico City that failing to keep up the intensity of the battle against cartels might persuade Trump to directly target criminal groups with cross-border strikes. Once again, Sheinbaum hopes to stay one step ahead by expanding security cooperation with the U.S. that might go beyond intelligence sharing. Yet there's still a concern within her administration that U.S. pressure for action will expand, perhaps extending beyond the cartels themselves to political or military figures in Mexico with alleged ties to organized crime. To head that off, Sheinbaum might take action against a few lower-level or former officials. But it is unlikely she would move against high-ranking figures within her Morena party or anyone close to López Obrador. Sheinbaum also has no appetite for an all-out war with the cartels. If there is a bloody escalation, she might not be able to contain it, and the U.S. might be brought more directly into the fight. But for the moment, there are no dominant crime lords in Mexico. New ones could emerge in the coming months and years, though over the past 16 years, Mexican and U.S. authorities have proved effective at capturing or killing top cartel leaders. Her administration will focus for now on containing violence as it erupts, with an overarching goal of degrading the strength of the most dangerous and effective cartels. That is a battle she has a much better chance of winning. The View inbox. The D.C. Brief by Philip Elliott, senior correspondent. James Talarico, T-A-L-A-R-I-C-O, I hope I'm pronouncing that at least close to being correct. The secularist seminarian, armed with a biblical rejoinder for what he sees as a politics sins, won Texas hard-fought U.S. Senate Democratic primary March 3, setting up a November push once seen as a Hail Mary for his party. It was opening night of primary season in the U.S., and with his 6-point win over the combative progressive Representative Jasmine Crockett, it appeared an argument grounded in electability this fall prevailed, or at least found enough open ears. This is a people-powered movement to take on this broken, corrupt political system, Tallarico said in his election night speech. This is proof there's something happening in Texas. Tonight, the people of our state gave this country a little bit of hope, and a little bit of hope is a dangerous thing. On the Republican side, things were heading toward another 2 bitter months of a bruising campaign between incumbent Senator John Cornyn and challenger Ken Paxton, the hard right and scandal-soaked state attorney general. Neither candidate topped 50% because Representative Wesley Hunt made it a 3-way contest. The runoff, scheduled for May 26, and gives Democrats a head start in what's shaping up to be a tough and costly battle that could decide which party runs the Senate for the final 2 years of President Donald Trump's term. Electability was the core argument on that side, too. If he's nominated, there's a high risk that Paxton would lose the Senate seat, taking 5 congressional seats down with him, Cornyn said on election night. Just like the primary, we have a plan to win the runoff, and we are in the process of executing it. Judgment Day is coming for Ken Paxton. The 1.5 million plus votes cast among Democrats was more than double the number seen in 2022. Among Republicans, a 1.3 million voted, up about 30% from 2022, according to Vote Hub. The results may offer a preview of party posture and other primaries and head-to-head matchups to come. On its own, though, it suggested Democrats' messy search for their path forward may be a battle at every step, and Republicans may struggle to figure out how to win definitively without Trump as a vote animator. Health Matters by Veronique Greenwood, staff writer. Think back to the first thing you can remember, and you will find you are already likely several years old. Between us and our earlier experiences lies a mysterious barrier. Research suggests that in mice, those lost memories still exist. At the lab of Paul Franklin of the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto, researchers tagged brain cells activated as young mice learned to fear a chamber. Later, when the grown mice had forgotten their fear, the researchers reactivated those cells, and the mice remembered. The lab of Tomas Ryan, a neuroscientist at Trinity College Dublin, has revealed that male mice whose mothers' immune systems were activated during pregnancy do not forget early experiences, suggesting the immune system may be involved. But what about humans? It is tricky. But Nick Turk-Brown at Yale and his colleagues have managed to scan a growing number of little kids and discovered those as young as a year old do appear to be forming memories. This suggests humans, too, may be making memories that just cannot be reached later. It is a mystery why our brains forget our early lives. Do our earliest memories pose a threat somehow to our survival? Or does the value of those memories lie in something that does not require their conscious retrieval? Perhaps they allow us to build a mental database of the way things work, Turk Brown speculates. The specifics, the things we hang on to in many of our memories, might not be what's valuable about them, and they might still be with us in ways we do not recognize. Alice Park writes 8 questions. Michael J. Fox, the actor and advocate on building his namesake foundation, living with Parkinson's disease, and what he learned from bullies. We may not finish all 8 questions here, but the first one is, this is question-answer format. What would be your message for people facing life-changing diagnoses? Answer, just be there every day and show up. Don't just look for the bad things. Look for things that are getting better, that you can change, where you can have an effect. Question, you have built the Michael J. Fox Foundation into the leading funder for research and breakthroughs in Parkinson's disease. How does the organization today fit with your initial vision? Answer, I want it to be a nudge. I wanted to push things along. When I first got diagnosed at 29, I was motivated by what I heard from the science people who said, the science is ahead of the money. They said, if you can direct money toward the right research, we can speed things along. I got the sense from the scientists that we were a few key answers to a few key questions away. Question. Has the pace of progress matched what you were initially hoping to see? Answer, no. I was very arrogant. I say that with all due respect to everything we've done, and we have done a lot, but we have not cured Parkinson's. And until you do it, it's not done. Question, do people in other advocacy groups come to you to ask how you built the foundation to be the force it is now and how to replicate it? Answer, yeah, and I am stuck for an answer. A lot of times we were two hands in the dark, feeling our way through. To support our initial research, I went to a lot of business people, and I knew they wanted to win, so I appealed to that ego side of them, to the winners who wanted to win, and I said, let's win against this disease. I will come in your office, I will take pictures with all of your employees, and I will pound you for money. Question, if you could travel back in time, what would you say to your younger self? Answer, just be tough and get it done. I was always a small guy. I was bullied and pushed around, and I would overcome that and push through it. Parkinson's is the biggest bully there is for me, and I'm not just going to let it get its way. We are going to have a fight, and I am going to get a few punches in. I may get beat up in the long run, but we will get it done. I am a, pardon my language, tough son of a bitch, and I am going to get it done. Question, and what about 30 years in the future? Answer, I would like to see a world without Parkinson's, and I think that will happen. I think in 30, 40 years, this will be done. Optimism is a powerful thing. Question. When you look at the things the foundation has funded that could potentially lead to a cure, what are you most excited about today? Answer. I am most excited about what we have done with biomarkers and the genetic front. Genetics loads a gun, and environment pulls the trigger. So we need to find the environmental trigger, too. But I think what I'm also proud of is Parkinson's patients now have an identity, and they do not have shame. There was a feeling when I came in that it was an old person's disease. Now people say, I have what Michael Fox has. And finally, the 8th question, what has it been like to be open about living with Parkinson's? Answer, I took 7 years before I disclosed my diagnosis, but when I did, I went online and into Parkinson's chat rooms, and I would go in anonymously, and I would ask, what do you think of this Michael Fox thing? And they would say, it's great. I would think, you're celebrating my having Parkinson's. But then I got it and realized These people were stuck in the rocking chair on the porch for all this time to just whittle away until they cannot move and never had a part in solving their problems. The more I thought about it, the more I thought it was a privilege and in a way a gift. It is a gift that keeps on taking. Time off reviews. Now this article may be a bridge for sure. Movies. Baz Luhrmann gives Elvis the tribute he deserves by Stephanie Zakarik. In the 1980s and 90s, you'd sometimes see Elvis Lives scrawled around this or that city or town. It was a furtive declaration with an unclear meaning. Was it a reference to the popular conspiracy theory that Elvis had not really died, August 16, 1977, at 42, but was hiding away somewhere, living as a private citizen? Or did it mean that after his death, the molecules of energy he'd left behind had simply taken on another living shape? Elvis died one death, only to spring back in an infinite number of forms, as uncountable as the stars in the sky. But sometimes Elvis goes a little underground. His reformed molecules can grow hazy. In the past few years, Baz Luhrmann has done the most to bring them back into focus. First with his fantastically unruly 2022 biopic Elvis, and now with a film that is less documentary than spiritual conjuring, epic, Elvis Presley in Concert. Get it? EPIC. Elvis Presley in Concert is constructed of previously unreleased footage, Luhrmann's Elvis researchers found. This trove, 59 hours of performance and interview material, had been languishing in a Warner Brothers vault located in an underground salt mine in Kansas. In addition, Luhrmann sourced rare Super 8 footage from the Graceland archives. This footage, painstakingly restored, forms the fabric of Epic, which, despite Luhrmann's penchant for hurtling over the top, or maybe because of it, feels profoundly intimate. Epic mixes concert footage with interstitial clips of Elvis being Elvis, as if to collapse the distance between his public and private lives. Luhrmann hopscotches through Elvis's early career, breezing over the cheesy movies, his stint in the army, during which he lost his beloved mother Gladys. We see glimpses of Elvis's manager, Colonel Tom Parker, whom Luhrmann frames as an evil manipulator, though in reality his role may not have been as diabolical. Luhrmann has also unearthed some hypnotic clips of Elvis performing in Hawaii in 1957, wearing a shimmering gold jacket, his neck ringed with a lei. This was Elvis near the peak of his beauty, when his pleasure in performing seemed to bathe him in radiant light. No wonder he got under people's skin. What they saw and identified as profanity was really a state of grace. But the film's core is footage from the hundreds of performances Elvis gave in Las Vegas from 1969 to 1976. His costumes alone are a wonder. Bell-bottom jumpsuits accented with Revolutionary War-era collars and cinched with macrame belts. A true sensualist, Elvis gave in to beauty without a second thought. In some of the Vegas footage, it is possible to see glimpses of the desperate figure Elvis would become. The hint of a jowl, a thickening waist, a gaze veering toward blankness. But mostly, the Elvis of Epic is alarmingly alive. His moves are smooth. His voice sounds burnished and vital. As he sidles into Polk Salad Annie, Annie's story seems to mesh with his own. Those greens were all her family had, but they did all right. Luhrmann spins these words in an echo chamber, even as he superimposes a ghostly-looking picture the famous black and white baby photo of Elvis nestled between his parents, atop the image of Elvis revving up to sing the song. In the picture, baby Elvis is the sunshine center of a family that also had nothing. Lorman isolates baby Elvis with his quizzical, knowing face and sends him whirling toward us. Is it corny, or is it everything? Lorman's gift as a filmmaker, as well as the very thing that can sometimes make him annoying, is that he always errs on the side of everything. He gives epic his all, and its joyous abundance almost feels like more than we deserve, just as maybe we never deserved Elvis. Yet there he was, giving us more, possibly, than he had to give. His life was great and vast and almost unbearably sad. The life he has now is better because he's given it over to us. And just by continuing to look at him and hear him, we build it anew day by day. That was the article in its entirety, and we've run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine, which is generously supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's us here at 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.